where is this earth headed? Everybody's got an answer, it seems. The evolutionists have their answer. They bought into Charles Darwin's theory that via natural selection, there's going to be these continued mutations over a long period of time, and things gradually will get better and better. So I would assume that their answer is the earth is headed for a good place. Now, the environmentalists, they have a different answer. They say, well, Mother Earth has existed for millions and millions of years, but it never seems to get larger. Every time there's some discovery or something, it seems like the number changes dramatically. Maybe it's billions of years now. But recently, man has come on the scene, and man has brought corruption and pollution, and we are involved in degrading the Earth, Mother Earth, as we know it. So what we need to do is invest all of our efforts to try to stem the tide of this gradual degradation, which is going to eventually lead to the collapse of the Earth. So you have, on the one hand, the evolutionists, there's gradual progress, and the environmentalists, there's gradual degradation. Then there's others that have answers to this question. The nihilists, their answer is, well, life doesn't have any objective meaning. You know, there's sort of, life is just nothingness. I mean, there's no purpose, there's no intrinsic value. They reject any kind of moral or religious values. Basically, their answer is the world's not headed anywhere, and who cares? You know, I mean, sort of, I don't know, but doesn't, that one's hard for me to wrap my arms around as how you live with that frame of reference. Now, the existentialists, they take a little bit different twist. Their philosophy emphasizes the uniqueness of the individual experience. It's all about what you experience as a person. And so your personal experience is the only thing that really matters. So they focus in on the now and just how you are interacting with that and what you are sensing and what is impacting you. And then the hedonists, they sort of run with that philosophy, but in the direction of, well, okay, well, then let's just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die, and, you know, we don't have any real focus on eternity for sure. And on where the earth is headed, we're focused on how can we maximize the pleasure and the enjoyment that we have in this moment of experience right now. So those are some of the answers that people give as to where the earth is headed. Of course, the creator of this earth has his own plans for its destiny. Just as Isaiah the prophet has already demonstrated in the chapters that we just looked at, the section that just concluded in chapters 13 to 23, he showed that God is sovereign over all the affairs of all the nations. He's in control of everything that's happening in all of these nations. He's going to bring judgment against self-reliance and against pride, against all these individuals who didn't have the love of the truth, as we saw from the passage that Charlie read today. They loved their own sin and their own pleasures more than the truth of God, and they chose to rely on their own resources and that of others rather than put their trust wholly in God. Well, just as Isaiah has shown that aspect of God's judgment on the nations, we're going to see that God is in the business of establishing his kingdom. He's got this plan for all of history. He's got this plan for the earth. The final chapter has already been written. God's demonstrated he's going to be victorious in the end. There's no question how things end up. God is going to reign forever. He's going to establish his kingdom, and he will be victorious overall. Now, as to how it impacts us, you know those highway signs that you see that say, you know, danger ahead, or you might see a sign that says, you know, caution, road out, you know, ahead. Well, or bridge out, you know. Well, that means, hey, you better not just keep going along your path as you're going, or you're going to drop off this precipice into the oblivion below. And so we see those road signs, and we heed them. You know, we understand what a warning sign is, and we alter our course accordingly. It's not so in terms of the warnings that God gives for the most part in the Scriptures. He gives warning after warning, and yet men and women, they think that they can just carry on their day-to-day life as they have before, and they refuse to heed or give any adherence to what God has to say. So they just blindly continue on and ignore God's warning signs. What we're going to see in this next section, we're beginning a new section of Isaiah this morning. It's chapters 23 to 27, four chapters that hang together. And in this chapter 23, we're going to see that the whole earth is headed for catastrophic devastation. Only the remnant remains to praise God. Thank the Lord that we are part of that believing remnant that He has chosen in His elective grace, that He has sanctified, that He has given a love for the truth, so that we will be spared the wrath to come that we read about this morning already. But the whole world, where it's headed, in a sad, sad case, the whole world is headed for catastrophic devastation. And that's what we're going to see this morning. We're only going to have time to really handle the first half of chapter 23, verses 1 to 16, and then we'll take the closing few verses next week that really get into a lot of the scenario of end time events. But these chapters, 24 to 27, they hang together as a unit, because now, instead of looking at all these individual judgments on all the nations, now they're all sort of wrapped up into this universal judgment on the whole earth. It's like all the individual streams flow into one big ocean of catastrophe that the prophet is going to look at. He's going to paint a contrast in these four chapters. He's going to paint a contrast between two cities. What we would call the city of man, which is called the city of chaos in the passage we're going to read. The city of man versus the city of God. Very much like Augustine wrote in his famous treatise. We're going to look at how these two cities, symbolic of the whole evil world system that stands against God, like the city of Babylon is pictured in the book of Revelation. That's what's given a foretaste of in these four chapters here. It's going to present this symbolic city of man and what happens to it versus God establishing His city and what's going to be the glory of that. It's interesting, one commentator, Mautier, I pronounced his name wrong in previous occurrences. I looked it up this time. It's not like it how it looks. It's written M-O-T-Y-E-R, but it's actually Mautier. He's given an interesting analysis of these four chapters where he again shows a chiastic type of a structure. It's very involved, and I won't try and develop it, but he tries to take these four chapters and show how they layer in, you know, A, B, C, C, B, A type of structure. Isaiah uses that type of idiom all the time in his work. But the heart of it, what you want to look at for emphasis is, okay, in that chaotic structure, the emphasis is on what's the center section in that whole structure. Turn to chapter 25. We'll actually start there. Chapter 25, verses 6 to 12, which speak of Mount Zion. Everything culminates with what God is going to do in establishing His kingdom city, Mount Zion, as opposed to the city of man. So in chapter 25, verse 6, this is the heart of this new section that we're going to study, chapters 24 to 27. Verse 6, the Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain. He keeps referring to that phrase, on this mountain is what these verses refer to. It's going to be a banquet of aged wine. It's going to be choice pieces with marrow, in contradiction to the destruction and devastation we're going to look at that takes place on the world. On this mountain, He'll swallow up the covering which is over all peoples, even the veil which is stretched over all nations. He will swallow up death for all time. The Lord God will wipe tears away from all faces. He will remove the reproach of His people from all the earth. For the Lord has spoken, and it will be said in that day, behold, this is our God, for whom we have waited that He might save us. This is the Lord, for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in His salvation. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain. And Moab will be trodden down in his place as straw is trodden down in the water of a manure pile. And he will spread out his hands in the middle of it as a swimmer spreads out his hands to swim. But the Lord will lay low his pride together with the trickery of his hands. The unassailable fortifications of your walls he will bring down, lay low, and cast to the ground, even to the dust. And that contrast, just speaking of Moab, symbolic of all the nations there in this passage, that lies at the heart of the section that we're going to look at here. So these chapters, I'm going to quote from Delitzsch now, who talks about the musical sort of tone that Isaiah uses here. He says these chapters, they form the finale to chapters 13 to 23 that we just looked at. It's strictly a musical type of tone. What the finale should do in a piece of music is gather up all the scattered changes into a grand, impressive whole. And that's what's done in these closing chapters. There's this grand hallelujah to the chapters of 13 to 23. It's hymnic in its character. It's musical in its form. And so we talk about how Isaiah is just a master of the Hebrew language. All the different ways that he uses for emphasis and for calling attention to the things that he wants to highlight. It's a lot of things. I'm impressed. Having in the past, I've sort of looked down my nose a little bit about how much can I gain from, if you really knew the Hebrew, the original language, you know, how much could you really gain if you knew that? Well, when you come to the book of Isaiah, you gain a lot. The better you are in Hebrew, and I have to get that from some other scholars for the most part. I'm pretty rusty on that area. But there is just the beauty of how Isaiah expresses things is very impressive. Another commentator, Constable, he says, many commentators refer to this section, these four chapters, as Isaiah's apocalypse because it reveals the culmination of history. It says, these prophecies, they help us to locate the judgments that he's talking about. He's talking about things that happened in the tribulation period, at the time of the return of Christ, during the millennial period, and then at the end of human history when the kingdoms transfer over and God reigns over all. You see the progression of those things, and even though they're not specifically developed with the detail that the book of Revelation would speak of them, they're here in kernel form in these chapters here in Isaiah. So this is sort of a mini apocalypse that is given. And also there are references backwards to the various judgments that God had brought upon the earth in early days. There's references in our passage. There's going to be references to Genesis chapter 1 to 3 and to the initial curse that God put upon the earth. There's going to be references to Noah's flood, huge parallels to the judgment that God brought at the time of Noah's flood, and then references to the Tower of Babel and what happened when he scattered the peoples at that time. So there's many connotations there. But we're in chapter 24. First half of chapter 24, there's really two major sections of judgment that alternate with two songs of praise. And we're going to go through the first cycle, which has a section on judgment, verses 1 to 12, and then a song of praise, verses 13 to 16. So we're going to look at that first cycle. Then there'll be another cycle of judgment and praise that we'll look at next week. So there are these two cycles, sections of judgment corresponding with sections of praise. So this first section, verses 1 to 12, catastrophic devastation and gloom on the entire guilty world in the day of the Lord. That's what he wants to speak of here. There's going to be catastrophic devastation and gloom that comes on the entire guilty world in the day of the Lord. Let's read from verse 1. Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste. He devastates it. He distorts its surface and scatters its inhabitants. And the people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, the maid like her mistress, the buyer like the seller, the lender like the borrower, the creditor like the debtor. The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. The earth mourns and withers. The world fades and withers. The exalted of the people of the earth fade away. The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth. Those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. The new wine mourns. The vine decays. All the merry-hearted sigh. The gaiety of tambourines ceases. The noise of revelers stops. The gaiety of the harp ceases. They do not drink wine with song. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. The city of chaos, that city of man that I spoke of, that city of chaos is broken down. Every house is shut up so that none may enter. There's an outcry in the streets concerning the wine. All joy turns to gloom. The gaiety of the earth is banished. Desolation is left in the city, and the gate is battered to ruins. Pretty depressing stuff. Like Charlie talked about, this is a pretty sobering message when you look at the destiny that God has in store for the earth that he created. He begins in the first three verses with the extent of this devastation. It's guaranteed to be complete. It's guaranteed to be total. God has spoken. He's the one that guarantees it and lets us know that this is going to happen for sure. And again, this is called an inclusio, another fancy word for a mini chiastic structure, where you have verse 1 and verse 3 are the same. Verse 1 and 3 are parallel, and then verse 2 in the middle of that. And so he wants to emphasize the extent of this devastation. He first calls us to attention with this word behold, where he's going to speak of something that's going to happen in the future, but something that has immediacy to it, something that should grab our attention, something that's dramatic, something that should really catch our attention. Behold, the Lord's about to do something. Take notice of what God is going to do. And again, this concept of the earth that's used here, it's not just speaking of the land, which would be the land of Judah, the land of the promised people. He's not talking about a judgment that's just going to come locally upon God's own people in terms of Judah and Jerusalem. He's talking about the whole earth. And so 17 times in this chapter, he uses this term, the earth, to reference the scope of how widespread this judgment is going to be. It's going to be upon the whole earth, just as Noah's flood came upon the whole earth. And so he wants to emphasize that it's going to encompass all people. And what he's going to do, it says here, he gives four references to what is going to characterize this type of devastation. He uses four different phrases. He says, first of all, he's going to lay the earth waste. He's going to empty it. The word could really be used as if you took a cup or a bottle and you turned it over and emptied it. In one sense, it's sometimes used in that sense, or laying waste so that there's nothing left. At the end of the day, everything's gone, and there's really nothing of value that's left. So we can't be hanging on to the things of this world. The things of this world, they're going to be emptied out. They're passing away. There's going to be nothing that's left of them. Then it says he devastates it. And these initial two Hebrew participles in the Hebrew, they sound very much alike. This idiom of assonance that Isaiah uses. These two words are bokek bolka, and how it reads in the Hebrew. So bokek bolka, and again, we miss that in the English translation. And so it's like if you take my outlines with their fancy alliteration, you know, and if you go translate them into Spanish, you know, there's no alliteration left in what I did in these outlines once you translated them. There's so much throughout this whole chapter, how he uses words that have the same sounds or the same beginning sound, and how he piles them together for impact. Thirdly, it says he distorts its surface. He bends it or twists it or mangles it. He takes what is a nice, pleasant face of the earth in all of its beauty, in all of its form, and he twists it and mangles it and distorts it so that it's hardly recognizable what you have left. It's a mess is what you're left with. It's almost, again, the picture of the flood where you have the foundations from above. Think of all the changes in the earth's structure that took place through the dramatic worldwide universal flood. There were all types of changes in the terrain of the earth that took place. Well, here, and God is going to do something even more devastating than the flood. He's going to twist it and mangle it, and it's going to be, in some sense, unrecognizable when he's done with it. And then it says, fourthly, he scatters its inhabitants. Of course, that reminds us of the Tower of Babel, where he comes down, he looks at the pride of men, and he says, oh, you think you can establish something that has significance? You think that you can take pride in your own accomplishments, even though I told you to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth? You think you can gather together and fortify yourself in this one location and build something that is more secure and has a comfort level for yourself? No, you won't, you know. I will confuse your languages. I will scatter you now across all of the earth and make it even more difficult than if you had just gone and fulfilled my command from the beginning like you were instructed to. And so this type of judgment calls us back to earlier things that God had already demonstrated his wrath and his judgment. Then in verse 2, he introduces this concept of class distinctions that are meaningless when it comes to God's judgment. He has six relationships that he goes through here in society where he contrasts, you know, one half of the equation with the other half of the equation. And it's very simple. He says, you know, when it comes to God's judgment, all people stand on level ground before God. There's no favoritism. So it's like when it comes to the cross of Jesus Christ, all people have the same problem of sin. We all stand guilty before God for all of sin and come short of the glory of God. The wages of sin is death for every man. No one can buy himself out of his problem. Everyone must come to the foot of the cross. Everyone must come to accept Jesus Christ as the substitute for their sins, as the one who paid the penalty for their sins. There's no other way to God. There's not some way that God deals with affluent people differently than he deals with the poor. He doesn't deal with servants differently than he deals with masters. And he goes through these different six relationships, and he basically says there's no favoritism with God. You can't in any way manipulate God so that somehow he owes you, or that you get some special dispensation or some special exemption that you think you might deserve. And there's no way to get around it. You know, you can't say, oh, well, I'm a preacher, you know, I should be excused by God. I should be able to get to do this, this, and this, because look at all the service I do for God. Or look at that. No, he says, when it comes to how God judges people, everybody is on the same footing, and God doesn't look at any of these distinctions. You can go through Romans chapter 1 to 3 and study Romans 1 to 3, and it's a great exposition of this same thought, that it doesn't matter how much light you have even. You might argue, well, wait a minute, you know, we have the privilege of the truth of God and the gospel revealed to us. What about the heathen in Africa? You know, what about the people who have never heard? You know, how can they be accountable before God? Paul treats them in Romans chapter 1 to 3. He says, they, from general revelation, they know certain things about the power of the invisible God. And they know certain things in their conscience that God has built into them. So they know externally and they know internally enough to make them guilty, because they've transgressed God's laws, his principles of what's right and wrong. Even if they didn't have the law, the Mosaic law, with the specific revelation, still they're on the same footing. And they all stand accountable before God's judgment. So we can look at that section, Romans chapter 1 to 3. In chapter 2, verse 11, it says there's no partiality with God. And then chapter 3, verse 19, it says all the world stands accountable and guilty before God. And you can study that section. That's exactly what is the import of verse 2 from Isaiah 24. So you can't buy your way out of this judgment. And then in verse 3, he just repeats for emphasis what he had said in verse 1, that this is going to be catastrophic devastation. And he uses a construction in the Hebrew. It's called the Hebrew infinitive absolute construction. Now, don't you like that? The Hebrew infinitive. You want to take that home, and you want to really spend some time on that one. All it means is he takes the same root word, and he repeats it twice, and that's where the emphasis comes from. So the word completely is not really in the Hebrew. What the Hebrew really says there, it says, emptied, there will be emptied the earth, and spoiled, it will be spoiled. And we come up with completely destroyed, completely emptied, to get that concept of emphasis. And the way the Hebrew did it was took the same root word, and in this construction, they just multiplied it to give emphasis. So again, Constable, he writes that the prophet predicted that the Lord would lay the earth waste, the sum total of all the nations. He would do the reverse of what he did in the creation when he brought order out of chaos. If you remember Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, he would devastate the earth, making it desolate. He would distort the surface of the earth, as when the flood changed the topography of this planet, and he would scatter the earth's inhabitants, as he did at Babel. And then, of course, he says in verse 3 that the word of the Lord has spoken this word. He wants to make it plain that this is how certain, this is how absolute we can take it, that these things are going to happen. He gives in verses 4 to 6, he moves from the extent of the devastation now to the explanation that he gives for the devastation. I mean, how can God do this? I mean, this is pretty severe. This is pretty drastic stuff. We're talking about the whole earth here. I mean, this doesn't seem right, you might say. And so he gives the explanation, God's curse against guilty sinners. He talks about, first of all, the impact on the earth and its inhabitants. He says the earth mourns and withers. Now we hear the earth responding as God comes and visits the earth in judgment. The earth responds. It says the earth mourns, it withers. The world fades and withers. The exalted of the people of the earth fade away. And so we have the impact on the earth and on the inhabitants of the earth. As to, doesn't matter if you were the influential, you could be the most exalted, the most influential people. Again, class distinctions don't matter. He says this is the type of devastation that's going to take place. And of course, we've seen in Paul's writings in the New Testament, Romans 8, where he talks about the creation being subjected to futility. was subjected to futility because of the fall, because it's awaiting, it's in bondage right now. The creation is looking forward expectantly to redemption. It wants to see redemption, just as we long for the full realization of our redemption. Well, creation itself is moaning and groaning, and here we see creation, the earth, moaning and groaning under the burden of judgment. And again, it's awaiting that final redemption that God is going to bring to it. The problem is not one of internal, it's not one of external drought that's happening and forces from without. It's corruption from within that is bringing the judgment here. And he's going to go and talk about the root problem. It says the root problem is sin and pollution. It says the earth is also polluted by its inhabitants. Wow, the earth is also polluted by its inhabitants. Okay, so the environmentalists, you see, they're right in this sense that we, the inhabitants of the earth, we're bringing great pollution. But the pollution we're bringing is not degrading the water supply so much. It's not because all of our cars are emitting so much exhaust into the ozone. Although those things are true and have a degrading effect, the pollution that God is pointing to is far more drastic and has a far bigger impact than that. He's saying what you should be concerned about is the pollution that comes from our hearts. The fact that our hearts are wicked and sinful and set in opposition to God and is therefore bringing about rebellion and pollution that impacts the whole world around us. So environmentalists, they do right. They're concerned with the pollution of the earth, but they ignore the most major root problem that really needs to be addressed, and that is the sin of man. And he goes on to be very specific about in what way has this pollution taken place. It says in three areas very specifically. What sinful men have done is they've transgressed laws, they've violated statutes, and they've broken the everlasting covenant. So this is the moral breakdown that is presented here. In terms of transgressed laws, that presents God's standards as sort of a barrier that man breaks through, that man crosses, and you know, God puts up limits, just like parents put up limits. And men say, We're not gonna abide by those limits. We're going to transgress, we're gonna break those limits and cross those. And we're going to and as a result of that, we're going to be judged by God to be guilty. We're going to change, we've changed the ordinances. This word change has to do with altering something. Van Paranack, he says regarding this, he says, an ordinance is literally something engraved on stone and therefore intended to be permanent, just like the Ten Commandments engraved on stones and the ordinances of God. And so he says that this verb here is really means to pierce through. It describes what Jael did to Sisera with the tent peg. Remember when she took the tent peg and she just nailed, he's sleeping, and she just took that tent peg and she pierced him through to the ground. It says when it talks about piercing through these ordinances, it's like taking those Ten Commandments and taking the chisel to it and just smashing those Ten Commandments and just driving that peg right through there and altering them and defacing them and changing the ordinances so that now we do, you know, we'll make up our own commandments. We don't like God's Ten Commandments. We don't like God's ordinances. We don't like God's standards. We're the ones. We'll decide what the standards will be. We will alter the ordinances to say, this is the way that we'll live. And so that's the type of change and the type of alteration and piercing that is in view here. And then this one is a little bit cryptic. Broken the everlasting covenant. I mean, what covenant is in view here? Most of the covenants that we see in the Old Testament have reference to the children of Israel. And you have the Abrahamic covenant, and you have the covenant, God's covenant, the Davidic covenant with the kingdom concept. And you have the new covenant. You have these various covenants. But I think the everlasting covenant goes all the way back to creation. It goes back to the conditions. God put certain conditions upon man in terms of obedience and what his expectations were, so that you saw from the very beginning, man had a concept of sin and had a concept that we need to bring sacrifices to God because of sin. Remember Cain and Abel bringing sacrifices, and they had this understanding that there were expectations in a covenantal sense to establish any relationship between man and God. There needed to be forgiveness of sins. There needed to be this everlasting concept of the covenant. Things way back from Genesis that were introduced along with this everlasting covenant. God laid down what his standards were in terms of marriage. You know, marriage is between one man and one woman for your entire lifetime. That is part of God's everlasting covenant that God does not want to see violated. God laid down the covenant of the sanctity of life. And so when we have abortions, when we have things that violate, they're violations of this everlasting covenant that starts way back in creation. God had designs for man in terms of how man would have dominion over the earth as God's sort of vice regents, as ones under God's authority, being given a stewardship by God. We're to carry things out, not as if we own things and possess them, but as if we have a stewardship from God in all that we do. And so we're to have this concept of stewardship that exists towards material possessions, towards how we relate to the earth and the environment around us. There's all these different aspects that I think you could go back and say that they all have some relationship, I think, to this concept of an everlasting covenant. Some people think it refers to the Noahic covenant, that after God judges the world at one time, he judges the world in Noah, and then he says, wow, he says, I'm not going to destroy the world again via a flood. That that's an everlasting covenant, and he laid down conditions that he said, I want you to obey me. I want you to choose to obey me. And yet man have violated that, and God's going to bring a judgment that ends up being more cataclysmic even than the flood, in terms of what's going to happen in the end time. So there's this moral aspect to giving the reason, the explanation for why God is bringing judgment. And it's because of man's transgression, man changing the ordinance, and men breaking the everlasting covenant. So the divine response is given here. The divine response, he speaks to the accountability and the judgment that man faces. Therefore, a curse devours the earth. Those who live in it are held guilty. Doesn't require any big explanation. The curse that God introduced way back at the fall of man there in the early chapters of Genesis, that curse falls upon every man for the soul that sins, it must die. That's the curse. God is going to carry out that curse. Now he's carrying it out upon the whole earth. Those who live in it, who live in the earth, they're held guilty because of their sin. So there's this accountability before God. There's this judgment that's related to the curse that comes from God. God has been very clear to spell out this curse wherever he lists the blessings that are available and the blessings that he offers to men. He also makes it plain that if you don't choose to submit to God and to have allegiance to God as your Lord, then there's the curses that would follow for retribution. So this divine response is very plain. And then he goes back to this impact on the earth. And he started with the impact on the earth and its inhabitants. He moved to the divine response, and he goes right back to the impact on the earth and its inhabitants. So that's how these verses hang together. He says, therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and a few men are left. Here's where you get the concept of the remnant introduced, that it's only going to be a few compared to the vast multitudes that are going to be destroyed in this great devastation. There's only going to be a few men left. And that concept of being burned, you have images of hellfire judgment, of eternal torment, of being condemned to a place of torment apart from the presence of God for all of eternity. Just as you have in John chapter John 15, where you have the vine and the branches, and you have the ones who profess to be in the vine but are not really, don't really have genuine faith, are not in the vine, and those dead branches that have no fruit and that have no life connection to the vine are not in Jesus Christ. They're gathered up and they're burned, and that image of burning and fire is often associated with God's wrath and his judgment, as it is here. The inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. So, as Jesus Christ put it, the way is broad that leads to destruction. There's many that flock down that path, and every day we rub shoulders with the bulk of people who are heading down that broad way, oblivious to that warning sign that says, hey, there's danger ahead. You know, the bridge is out. You know, you want to take heed. And yet they're streaming down that broad way because the gate's narrow. Few there be that find that narrow gate. And that's why we have the responsibility to proclaim that gospel of good news, to say there's a way to avert this tragedy that's spoken of here. He moves on in verses 7 to 12, talking now about the emotion that accompanies this devastation. The shallow joy, the gaiety that men have been experiencing, it's going to be replaced with deep gloom. And so he moves from just this sort of party atmosphere and this drinking and revelry, he moves from that to just the deep gloom that's going to overtake mankind as they experience this judgment. Beginning in verse 7, the good times are gone. The source of joy has been removed. It says, the new wine mourns. The vine decays. Men had put their hopes in the wine and the vine that produces the grapes. And they had chosen different strategies to anesthetize themselves from the realities of their responsibility and accountability to God. Instead of facing up to what their responsibilities were in this life, what their relationship should look like on the vertical scale with God, on the horizontal scale with one another, instead of being faithful in those relationships, men had chosen to just escape reality in whatever way they could. The way that's pointed to here is, well, they found that wine and strong drink was an attractive way to just forget about what was going to take place down the road. Just enjoy yourself for now. And so we have to think of ways in which our culture sort of escapes reality. We have a lot of creative ways. You know, we have the TV to escape reality. We've got entertainment. We've got sports. We still have the drugs and the alcohol and the things that we can abuse from that type of perspective. But we have all different ways that we can find to plug ourselves into something where we don't have to think. We can just sort of vegetate and we don't have to relate to God. We don't have to relate to others, and we can just sort of ignore the realities that should be in front of us. And that's what he's speaking of here, as he speaks of what they had done in terms of this wine and the revelry that they had. All these good times that they thought, oh, well, it's good. We're having a great time, and no one can criticize me. You know, how can you ask me to check out my life and to think about God? I don't need to do that. I'm having a great time, man. Don't come to me with any considerations. Well, these good times are gone because the gaiety, it says, is now replaced by gloom. It says, all the merry-hearted sigh. The gaiety of tambourines ceases. See, the song has died. The music stopped playing. There's no more music playing. The noise of revelers stops. The gaiety of the harp ceases. They do not drink wine with song. In fact, strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. So now you can't even get anything good from trying the things that you tried before. Now it's nothing but bitterness to you because you realize the deep trouble that you're in. And so now you're desperate with no hope. There's no place to turn to because all the resources that you used to turn to, where you used to look for relief and for hope and for trying to ignore these realities, all those things are stripped away. And they have no more impact in terms of providing an anesthetic to you. And so now you just have the full brunt of the pain and the needle and the surgery that God is inflicting on you. And now you're taking it big time, taking the hit. So he says that there's an outcry in the streets concerning the wine. I think now they might even want to go get some more, and they can't even get any. They're not even available, you know. They probably are looking, well, I'll try it again, even though it tasted bitter or whatever, or it doesn't seem to satisfy. It's the only thing I know. Let me have some more. Let me try. I can't even get any. You know, now there's an outcry in the streets concerning the wine. All joy turns to gloom. That's the message, the emotional message that Isaiah is summing up here, is when it comes to emotions, joy, they didn't have true happiness and true joy that would be centered in a relationship with the Lord Jesus. They didn't have a right relationship with God. They had superficial happiness and just very shallow type of existence. But even that shallowness, it all turns now to gloom. The gaiety of the earth is banished. What's left is this ghost town. They have a ghost town. It's the town, the city is destroyed. The city is defenseless. It says desolation, verse 12. Desolation is left in the city. This is how he finishes up these first 12 verses dealing with catastrophic devastation. He says desolation is left in the city. And the gate is battered to ruins. So he's saying that there's no way to defend the city, and everybody can just sweep on in, and we are now being overrun, and we're in the midst of this state of gloom. So he says, he moves on in verse 13 to 16. We see very surprising, a very abrupt change in emotion, in tone, and focus. As you get to verses 13 to 16, it's very surprising to see what happens here. He starts in verse 13, he says, "For thus it will be in the midst of the earth among the peoples, as the shaking of an olive tree, as the gleanings when the grape harvest is over." There's this aspect of the meager gleanings that are available after a full harvest. And he's going to talk here in this section, 14 to 16, he's going to talk about the worldwide songs of praise that now come from the meager remnant that's left to glorify the Lord. So now there's still this remnant idea. There's this meager remnant that's left after harvest time, and they come from all parts of the world. They're not just a remnant that comes from Judah. These could be Ammonites. These could be Philistines. These could be all the nations that we talked about in chapters 13 to 23. There's remnants from all those nations that are going to experience deliverance by the hand of God, and they're not going to experience the devastation. And so just like you took an olive tree, and when it came harvest time, you take that olive tree and shake it, shake it, shake it, and you get all the olives off of it you can. You harvest everything you can, and when you're done shaking that olive tree, look at that. There's still a couple that still cling on to the branches there. There's a couple that we just left, and that somebody can glean those maybe if they put a lot of effort into it. But there aren't many. It's not worth our time. There's just a few left on that tree. And so he says, just like the shaking of an olive tree or the grape harvest, when you go through and you pick tediously, you pick by hand all those grapes off the vine, and there's a few left. There's a few stragglers here and there. It wasn't worth your time to clean it 100%. But you got the bulk of it, and there's only a few of those grapes left on the vines. He says that's what the remnant of God's people will be like. And it'll be a remnant that comes from the Gentile world as well as from God's people in Judah and Jerusalem. So it's a worldwide remnant that is spoken of here. But they're going to be very meager gleanings. But these meager gleanings, after this time of great judgment, are going to gather together and raise their voices in majestic songs of praise that are going to come from the ends of the earth. So he finishes in verses 14 to 16. He says, "They raise their voices. They shout for joy. They cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord. Therefore glorify the Lord in the east, the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, in the coastlands of the sea. From the ends of the earth we hear songs, glory to the righteous one." If you look at these phrases that are multiplied together in these couple of short verses, I think they speak, first of all, to the intensity of the praise. They shout, they raise their voices, they cry out. So there's an intensity that's involved in the worship and the praise. There's the worldwide scope that's emphasized. So they come from as far as the east is, from the west, and in the Hebrew it doesn't really say it in terms of east and west. It sort of says from the Mediterranean, speaking of one direction, and has a little bit different language, but it really is wants to give you that worldwide impact from the east, as far as the east is from the west, and then it spells it out from the ends of the earth. So that's what we're talking about, this worldwide scope of the praise of all of mankind. But then, most importantly, I think you have the focus of the praise, four different perspectives on the character of God, on the Lord of hosts, on who it is that we're worshiping. What are we ascribing in terms of worth and praise to this God? And there's four different perspectives on this Lord of hosts. The first perspective is that of His majesty. He's the one that is over all. He's the one that is high and lifted up. So He's the majestic one. So we sing and we praise Him with respect to His majesty. We praise Him with respect to His name. Everything relating to His character and His attributes, the name of the Lord, everything that involves, we give praise to Him because He's the perfection of all of those attributes. He is the beauty that you have of all of those attributes. And then He's the God of Israel. And then fourthly, He is the righteous one, which is quite a testimony, because on the heels of this great catastrophic destruction of the earth, you might think there would be a voice of complaint, a voice that would say, as Abraham might have said back to God, "How can you destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? How can you destroy the whole city? You know, that's not like you." Well, Abraham came to see that shall not the judge of all the earth, do what is right, do what is righteous. And the people of God, at the end here, they're not looking back in a lament on how could God be so harsh and severe in His judgment. They now have, they're in line with the character of God. God isn't looking back and lamenting and saying, man, I shouldn't have judged him like that. You know, that was pretty bad on my part. God's not second-guessing himself like that. God is saying, I am glorified in the destruction of the wicked, just as I'm glorified in the salvation of the elect. And so the elect here are having that same concept that God has of his righteous character and glorifying God for his righteousness and the fact that he exhibits his just nature and his holiness against sin and his wrath that comes out. All of these things consistent with the character of God. The people of God are joining in throughout the whole world in an intensity, giving praise to God for that respect. So in conclusion, I remember the book that Francis Schaeffer wrote. It was called, How Should We Then Live? And that's what the Bible is all about. You don't read all of this and study all of that just to say, wow, you know, that's interesting. What God says is, you study the first half of chapter 24 and your heart should say, how should we then live? What's the difference? Who cares? What does it matter to me? How is my life different? How should we then live? 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 to 17 answers the question for us. It says, do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away. That's what Isaiah wants us to know. That's what those signs tell us. Beware, there's danger ahead. The world is passing away. And also its lust. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. So let's examine our affections. Let's love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind. Let's love our neighbor as ourselves. Let's examine our priorities. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Let's examine our pursuits. As Paul said, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. And don't try to hold on to the world. Don't try to hold on to the things that pertain to this world. Make no mistake. God has spoken. What God has said, the world is passing away. Let's pray.